schools all over the country today, children will participate in plays, recite poems, and display artwork in an effort to celebrate and recreate the story of Christopher Columbus. They will no doubt hear of his brave journey and his vision to prove that the world was not flat. They will also learn of his discovery of the New World and of his Indian encounters there. This story is one that is all too familiar to every American, and like many other heroic stories of America's past, they go unquestioned and remain a foundation of what we know as America's history and culture. The true story of Christopher Columbus is one of many firsts, though one of great brutality, arrogance, and ignorance, rather than valiance and courage. Cristoforo Colombo, Cristobal Colón, or as we know him, Christopher Columbus, was born on the coast of Italy near Genoa around the year 1451. He was born to Domenico Colombo and his wife Susanna Fontana Rosa. He had three brothers, Bartolomeo or Bartolome, Giacomo or Diego as he was known, and Giovanni Pellegrino. His father was a wool weaver with good status in the community. Columbus was homeschooled and later attended Prince Henry's School of Navigation. As a young man, after traveling at sea as a trader and merchant's clerk, while gathering navigational knowledge and geography, he met up with his brother Bartolome in Lisbon, Portugal. Prince Henry of Portugal built the tower at Sagres Point, which became an academy that later moved to Lisbon, where it became a hub for seamen and merchants traveling Henry's southern routes along the western coast of Africa. It was in Lisbon that Columbus, with the help of his brother Bartolome, found himself aboard Portuguese ships where he traveled as a merchant to Ireland and the Azores. He then married and continued at sea out of Madeira, where he traveled to the African coast bartering, among other things, alluvial gold. One of the many myths often told of the Columbus story was that he was on a mission to prove that the world was not flat. It was general knowledge by most educated people at the time that the world was round. At 500 years BC, the Greeks had already drawn and documented this conclusion. During the mid-1400s, Europeans were making nautical advancements and exploring southern routes around the West African coast in search of the Indies. The eastern Mediterranean routes had been closed to Europeans by Turkish conquest, which had, until that time, been heavily traveled passage toward China and India, where trade was lucrative. Around 1480, after studying the works of Aristotle and Marco Polo, Columbus came across the Toscanelli papers. Paolo Toscanelli was a Florentine philosopher who drew up a map based on Marco Polo's distances in Asia that Columbus was convinced would help him reach Asia by traveling west. Most believed that the distance west to Asia via the Atlantic Ocean was far too great. There was no chance that a ship at that time could cross a distance of over 10,000 nautical miles. Columbus's far-fetched estimates reduced this distance to only one-fourth that length. Little did he know that he would later find himself in the Caribbean, which he argued to his death was along the southeastern coast of Asia. This is when Columbus's search for sponsorship began. It took him several years to finally sell this theory. He was turned down several times by King John II of Portugal, and it was King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella who granted Columbus their blessings for his first voyage. They hoped at whatever price to be the first to find new channels to the Indies. He then purchased and loaded his ships, the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and set off in August of 1492, beginning their journey down the Tinto River. It was on September the 6th when they sailed away from Gomera and deep into the Atlantic. There are still many who will argue a more traditional and often romantic version of this story. In many attempts to distort and recreate history, the true story of his travels and arrival in the Western Hemisphere remain buried beneath elementary school mythology. This history is buried even farther beneath the celebrations and many statues and street names throughout the country that are in place to honor his arrival and discovery. But what is it that's really being honored here? As early as 1792, Americans have celebrated the Columbus legacy. In 1892, President Benjamin Harrison urged citizens to participate in the 400th anniversary of Columbus's first voyage. In 1937, President Roosevelt proclaimed October 12th as Columbus Day, and in 1971, President Nixon declared the second Monday of October a national holiday. Like many stories of American ancestors and forefathers, we are presented with the mythical and symbolic story of elitist discovery and dominance, a Eurocentric iconic figure which simplifies and replaces the true narrative of America's past. This is a celebration fit only for a select few and is widely used as a means to indoctrinate generation after generation of the American mass. Do we all have something to celebrate? Especially those of color who have felt the heaviest of the colonial burden. Roberto Mucaro Borrero is the president of the United Confederation of Taino People. He offers some insight into today's discussion here.
First, I'd like to just say Takahi, Natiao, Daka Mucaro, Boriken Taino Daka. And just greeting you in the Taino language, and in case you didn't understand that, that's okay, because Columbus didn't understand that 500 years ago either, but basically I'm just greeting you in our language as a brother, and informing you of my Taino name, and also what island I'm from, or my family's from the island of Boriken, which is known today as Puerto Rico. And, you know, when we're talking about Columbus, you know, I agree with you when you link Columbus to colonialism, and we can even go further and link them to imperialism, you know, and the beginning of that process in this hemisphere. As the storybooks and the nursery rhymes go, and Columbus arrived over into the Caribbean in 1492 after he sailed the Ocean Blue. And he arrived not in the U.S. or anywhere else, but he did arrive in the Caribbean islands, first up in the Bahamas. And not too long after that, then he made his way south and hit other islands up the coast of Cuba or Cuba. And then on to what's known today as split between two political realities, Dominican Republic and Haiti. Back then, Columbus named that island Hispaniola. And amongst the Taino people, there was various names for the very large island, one being Quisqueya, another Bohio, and there's other names as well. Haiti, another one, but what I think it's important to note is that, you know, when he arrived, Cristobal Colón, which is his name in Spanish, Cristobal Colón, and as far as I understand it, it translates to Christ-bearing colonizer. And which is pretty much what he was, and he was known to be a very, have a religious fervor, and he brought those ideals, very strong, staunch idealism related to his religion, and you know, his idea was, I guess basically, according to the history books, was that his idea was to amass money to help continue the campaigns against the Moorish Empire and free Jerusalem and the Holy Lands from the Moorish, or, you know, what we know now as Islamic influence, you know. So that kind of ideology arrived with him, this kind of crusader ideology, and, you know, not only bringing his ideal of finding this new way to reach these spice lands in Asia, but also to spread the word of the Christian faith and to seek converts. And he would do that by any means possible. I mean, either through conversionism or military means, and that's the reality. I think for the indigenous peoples of the islands, my ancestors in the various islands, it had to be a very, very confusing time, because in the beginning, when he arrived to the first couple of islands, he tried to do what most explorers did at that time: meet with the local peoples and trade with them, and usually trading what we would consider trinkets today, to find what they were looking for, and that usually amounts to gold or human beings for slavery purposes. And so after he arrived in the first few islands, you could see by his logbooks, I mean a lot of what we get today, that where we can back up a lot of what we're talking about as far as his attitude, you know, what he did, the way he thought about things, is written down in logbooks and letters that were transmitted over the centuries. And in his own logbook, you can see right from the beginning that he's sizing the places up, sizing the islands up, sizing the people up, and really almost taking like an inventory, like a storekeeper or anybody who's looking at something with through eyes filled with profit motives, you know, capitalism. And so he's really talking about materials on the island. He's saying that this finer wood than that found in where he was from, many fine birds, and the people grew cotton, and just all sorts of stuff that was really an inventory of what these first pirates and mafiosos of the hemisphere were going to be looting out of this out of these areas, you know. So in the beginning, our people received them well, with curiosity, but like anybody who knows anything about island cultures and how people are in those areas, or many native people in general, they know that there's a lot of trading going on between communities, a lot of interaction, and a lot of that interaction, at least in the old days, was based on trade and on locating items that were not normally found in your own homelands, and you know, having these linkages and these networks to get other items and to interact with other people. At least that was the Taino perspective at that time. Our ancestors were very big traders. Las Casas and other early chronicles, people who wrote down this early history at the end of the 15th and 16th and the beginning of the 16th century, they remarked how amazed they were with some of the Taino canoa, or the canoes that our Taino people made at that time. Some of them could hold up to 150 people. And, you know, if you have large canoes like that holding 150 people, the people are very aware of what happens out in the ocean, the currents. They have a maritime culture, in other words, and they made it from island to island. And not only island to island, but there's also evidence via archaeology, as well as a local indigenous tradition of contacts with the mainland. And that could be mainland Central America, mainland North America via Florida, which the Taino called Bimini, as well as South America, which many people are aware as our people are connected and related to the Arawak cultures of Northern South America.
On October 11, 1492, in Columbus's own logbook, he reflects on his interaction with the Taino people. He writes how they all go naked as their mothers gave them birth, and the women also. They were very well built, with very handsome bodies, and very good faces. Their hair was almost as coarse as horses' tails and short, and they wear it over their eyebrows, except a small quantity behind, which they wear long and never cut. Some paint themselves blackish, and they are of the color of the inhabitants of the Canaries, neither black nor white. And some paint themselves white, some red, some whatever color they find. They do not carry arms, nor know what they are, because I showed them swords, and they took them by the edge and ignorantly cut themselves. They have no iron. Their spears are sticks without iron. They are all generally of good height, of pleasing appearance, and well built. They must be good servants and intelligent, as I see that they very quickly say all that is said to them. And I believe that they would become, easily become Christians, as it appeared to me that they had no sect. If it please our Lord, at the time of my departure, I will take 6 of them from here to your highness, that they may learn to speak. The following Saturday, he continues that they came to the ship with canoes, which are made from the trunk of a tree, like a long boat, and all in one piece, and very wonderfully fashioned for the country, and large enough that 40 or 50 men came in some of them, and others were smaller. They brought balls of spun cotton, parrots, and spears, and other small things which it would be tedious to write about, and gave everything for whatever might be given them. And I was attentive, and sought to learn whether they had gold, and I saw that some of them wore a small piece suspended from a hole that they have in their nose. And I was able to understand by signs that, going to the south, or going around the island to the south, there was a king who had large vessels of gold, and who had a great deal of it. I tried to have them go there, and afterwards saw they were not interested in going. I determined to wait until afternoon of the next day, and then leave for the southwest in search of gold and precious stones. Columbus made his way through the Caribbean islands, searching for resources such as spices and gold. Along the way, Columbus's crew captured several groups of indigenous people. In December, one group of Colba from the island of Cuba were taken to help search for gold. During that trip, the Santa Maria was damaged against a reef outside of the northwest island of what is now Haiti. With the help from local indigenous communities, Columbus's crew was rescued, and with wood taken from the broken ship, the first fort was built. Columbus named it Puerto de Navidad, or Christmas Harbor. Not long after leaving the fort, Columbus encountered Caribs from the island of Puerto Rico. They had a short battle where the Dominican Republic is today. This was but a small example of what would later come. By this time, all the ships had taken prisoners, and they set sail back to Castile to report their findings. Bill Bigelow.
What people mostly know is the first voyage, and which is always presented as a kind of benign, you know, Columbus comes with 3 ships and 100 guys and plants the flag and discovers America and goes home and holds a press conference. What's not so well known is the second voyage, which was really the beginning of the invasion. With 17 ships and between 12 and 1,500 men, and the arrival of sugar cane and the beginning of plantation agriculture and the beginning of really massive slave taking and taking the Taino people who were living there and turning them into slaves. And when slavery there was not profitable enough, Columbus took hundreds of Taínos as slaves and sent them back to Spain, where most of them died. And so, in fact, Columbus is called by Basil Davidson, the probably preeminent historian of Africa. He calls Columbus the father of the slave trade.
Ah, yes, the world, planet Earth, third from the son of a gun. 360 degrees, and as new worlds emerge, stay alert, stay aware, watch the eagle, watch the bear. Earthquake and foundation shaking, bias breaking, new day making change. Accumulating, liberating, educating, stimulating change. Tomorrow was born yesterday. From inside the rib or the people cage, the era of our first blood stage was blotted, or erased, or TV screened and defaced. Remember, there's a revolution going on in the world. One blood of early morning revolved to the one idea of our tomorrow. Homeboy, hold on. Now more than ever, all the family must come together. Ideas of freedom and harmony, great civilization yesterday, but today will bring tomorrow. Neon, Leon, fast lane, brother, you were yesterday when dreams of karma and life still live. As it was in the beginning, so shall it be once again. Earthquaking, foundation shaking, investigating yesterday. I was wondering about our yesterdays and digging through the rubble. And to say the least, somebody went to a hell of a lot of trouble to make sure that when we looked things up, we wouldn't fare too well, and we would come up with totally unreliable pictures of ourselves. But I've compiled what few facts I could, I mean such as they are, to see if we could get a little bit of light. This is what I got so far. First, white folks discovered Africa and claimed it fair and square. Cecil Rhodes couldn't have been robbing nobody, cause hell, there wasn't nobody there. White folks brought all the civilization, wasn't none around. How could these folks be civilized when wasn't nobody writing nothing down? And to prove all their suspicions, well, didn't have to wait too long. They discovered there were whole tribes of people in plain sight with no clothes on. That's right. The women, the men, the young and the old righteous folks covered their eyes. And no time was spent considering their environment. Hell no, this just wasn't civilized. Another way they knew the folks were backwards, or at least this is how we were taught, is that unlike the civilized people of Europe, these tribal groups actually fought. And yes, there were some rather crude implements, and yes, there was primitive art. And yes, they were masters of hunting and fishing, courtesy came from the heart. And yes, there were medicines, love and religion, intertribal communication by drum. But no paper and pencils and other utensils, and these folks never even heard of a gun. So this is why the colonies came, to stabilize the land. The Dark Continent had copper and gold, and the discoverers had a plan. They would discover all the places with promise and didn't need no leases or deeds. Then they'd appoint people to make everything legal to sanction slavery and greed. And when the natives got restless deep in the jungle, they would call it guerrilla attack. And never described it, folks finally got wise and decided that they would fight back. Still, we are victims of word games. Semantics is always a bitch. Places once called underdeveloped are now called mineral rich. And still we are constantly hounded with unity just beyond reach. Egypt and Libya used to be in Africa, they've been moved to the Middle East. There are examples galore, I assure you, but if interpreting was left up to me, I would swear every time this version ain't mine. That's why it's called his story. Earth shaking, foundation quaking, bias breaking, new day making change.
On Columbus's second trip to Hispaniola, he arrived with a whole new attitude and agenda. This arrival proved much more bloody than the first one, and set a precedent for centuries of conquest to come. His caravel, once again, made its way through the various Caribbean islands before setting foot once again in Hispaniola. There they found the Fort Puerto Navidad, only with the remains of 10 of their original settlers. Through an interpreter, Columbus found that the original Spanish settlers had formed into various bands of gangs who ravaged the island in search of gold and lust. They took what they wanted, including women and young boys, until eventually the indigenous people of the island rose against their invaders and killed each one of them. It wasn't long after landing that Columbus took on the same role, though more ferocious and savage than the small settlement before him. His appetite for gold was endless, and the slaughter that took place was beyond words. Trained dogs were sent in teams to hunt the Arawak, along with crossbowmen. The indigenous on the island of Hispaniola, Cuba, and Jamaica felt the brunt of this brutality as they were killed and rounded up as slaves. In January of 1494, Columbus began building his second fort in Hispaniola, which was named Isabella after the Queen of Spain. It was in the fort of Isabella where 1,500 Arawak men, women, and children were rounded up and imprisoned. 500 were sent back to Spain, though only 300 survived the trip. The enslavement of Arawaks to Spain proved unprofitable, so this venture was short-lived. The Arawak were then used to collect gold, copper, and cotton. When they came up short, their limbs were cut off, and or they were killed. In a span of 2 years, at least half of the indigenous inhabitants of Hispaniola had been killed. The remainder were enslaved as Spanish occupied the island. As the entire nation of Arawak people were decimated, slaves from Africa were brought in to replace them.
In 1441, two Portuguese captains pick up 12 Africans, brought them to Cabo Branco, Portugal, as slaves. This is the beginning of the slave trade. They were so successful that just 4 years after, a tax collector from Lagos set up trade with Africa. This was in about 1444. Don't go nowhere, cause there's a whole lot more. In 1452, the first time sugar's planted on an island, Portugal. That same year, Pope Nicholas V proclaims that if you're not a Christian, you could be put in chains. For years, the Portuguese monopolized the slave game. They were so large, they set up shop in Seville, Spain. Now in 1476, despite papal opposition, the Spanish got down with the dish. It was a captain named Carlos de Valera. He brought back 400 men from Africa. 1481, Diogo da Azambuja builds a castle at Almina. That's modern-day Ghana. Not only was it one of the day's busiest ports, it was also one of slavery's most notorious forts. 1483, the discovery of the Congo River. A gold mine if your goal was enslaving. Again, 1492. Columbus sails the ocean blue.
Yeah, all right, LaVora, once again. First, you hawk the jewels, you give me the money, and I buy the ships. Then I discover the new world, you dump the king, and I'll send for you.
You say you'll send for me, darling, but will.
Now, look, we've been all through this before.
I know, but really, you're such a dreamer. You'll go out there, and you'll sail right off the edge of the world.
After months and months at sea, death and all type of drama, Chris lands on San Salvador, modern-day Bahamas. 1493, on Columbus' second voyage, he starts the transatlantic trade, enslaving the Taino village. He brought it from Hispaniola, that's the DR, to Spain. It gets even more insane. 1499, Vespucci and Ojeda take natives from South America this time. When Columbus did it, there were legal issues in the past. This time they had no problem selling they natives at. 1500, it starts to get real ill. Pedro Cabral sets foot on Brazil. 1502, a guy named Juan Cordoba is the first merchant on record to send Africans over. He was only allowed one by Spanish authorities, but other dirty merchants sent two or three. 1509, Columbus' son Diego Colon, governor of the empire at that time, said the native slaves were lazy and they worked too slow. 1510, 50 black slaves are shipped to Santo Domingo. 1513, Ponce de Leon, the first European to touch American soil. He landed on the coast, modern day Florida, as is known to most. 1516, on a ship, a huge native slave rebellion. They killed the crew and sailed back home. 1519, here comes Magellan. 1521, Cortes slaughters the Aztecs. 1522, slaves in Española break their masters' necks. 1526, the German put slaves on ships. 1532, Pizarro kills the Incas in his ship. 1562, the English get into the mix. John Hawkins brought back blacks, potatoes, and tobacco from his trips. 1579, the United Provinces is formed, and the trading machine of the Dutch is born. Now I could go on and on and on and on, but for practical reasons, it'll take too long. To all my brothers claiming that they Hispanic and Latino, you are African, Aztec, Incan, and Taino. Now that I showed you how these nations gained their wealth, I hope I piqued your interest, so check it out for yourself.
With this history, it's clear to me that this story, by no means, is any reason for celebration. Why would I celebrate the genocide and enslavement of my ancestors? Juan Gonzalez writes in his book, Harvest of Empire, that by the late 1500s, a mere century after the conquest began, scarcely 2 million natives remained in the entire hemisphere. In average of more than 1 million people perished annually for most of the 16th century in what has been called the greatest genocide in human history. The African slaves brought across the Atlantic after Columbus's arrival continued for centuries. A combination of both the genocide and slavery of black and brown people laid the foundation for colonization of nations, including and especially the United States, many years after. Roberto Mucaro Borrero continues here.
You're absolutely right. A majority of our community, and I would, hopefully think most of our community, most all of our community, is opposed to the celebration. We have to remember that Columbus has been used as a symbol, and that early on in the history of the United States, they didn't celebrate Columbus Day as they do now. Now the celebration of Columbus Day and the idolizing of Columbus as a symbol, you know, has reached the near religious proportions. I mean, you can't, you know, if you criticize Columbus, there's a whole cadre of scholars and naysayers crying foul. How dare, you know, this person brought civilization to this side of the world, civilization and God. You know, but from the indigenous perspective, Columbus brought over the Bible, but he also brought over the devil, diseases, and many other things that we would rather be without, or rather have not really encountered at all, or at least in that way. And, you know, we go all over the place. You can see in many cities there are statues dedicated to Columbus and other colonizers. And really, if you think about it, people who have suffered similar fates, such as Jewish peoples or even African Americans, they wouldn't want to see symbols of oppression against their communities touted in certain areas. For example, you wouldn't go down the street in any given city here in the United States or elsewhere and find a monument dedicated to Hitler because of the Holocaust that ensued as a result of his campaigns, you know, against peoples and his ideals for world domination. And in the same way, you know, you have in African American communities, people, you know, who get very upset when they see a Confederate flag flying in certain areas. Why? Because that Confederate flag is linked to the enslavement of many of their ancestors. So when you think about things like that, think about how people have been oppressed over time and those symbols of oppression. You know, you can probably understand why we, seeing a statue of Columbus or seeing people celebrate Columbus in such a way that it's like this big heroic image and actually based on a lot of romanticism. You know, there's all this talk about how Columbus thought, you know, that the people of the world thought the earth was flat at that time, and how Columbus, you know, as a boy always had these dreams, and there's just a lot of romanticism around the whole Columbus story. And when you really start breaking it down, you see that a lot of these things are really just based on fallacies. You know, for example, the people who were Columbus's contemporaries during that time period at the end of the 15th century, the end of the 1400s into the 1500s, they already knew the world was round. You know, this was already something that had come out and that had been debated and that was understood. But yet, you know, that kind of mythology persists, even so much where you have Knights of Columbus halls and the Sons of Italy, for example, you know, who kind of latched on to Columbus as some kind of hero for the Italian people. And, you know, if you look at the history of Italy, I think there's a lot better heroes that they can attach a claim to than Christopher Columbus. If you look at the history of what happened to him during his time in the Caribbean, when he quote-unquote discovered the New World, you know, he was not a good administrator. He was sent back to Spain in chains because of his poor administration. Many of the people that he brought along with him were really just not nice people at all, you know. And there was a lot of gold fever happening, and all kinds of things that made for a very bad scenario in those early times for our people. And you know, that's where slavery began in the hemisphere, right? In the beginning of when Columbus was going from island to island, he captures 7 Taínos with the intent of bringing them back to Spain and teaching them the language so that they could be used in the further conquest of the islands upon his return. You know, he made 4 trips back and forth to the Caribbean island region. And right away, of course, some of our people escaped, and, you know, some didn't, and one Taino even converted and came back with him and was one of his chief translators in the very beginning. But, you know, we have to remember that this is the beginning of slavery in the hemisphere, and it started with Taino people being taken and brought back to Spain, and other native peoples being brought into the islands to work in either gold mines or later on sugarcane fields and things in that nature. But I think that's an important starting point, that we have to link Columbus to the ideal of the first transatlantic slave trade, you know, that occurred in the hemisphere. And we all know what happened after that. The results can be seen all throughout the society today, and why certain groups of people think that there's almost a privilege in the way that they govern and in the way that they've shaped the society.
Roberto Borrero continues here on the connections between colonialism and imperialism and extreme interpretations of Christianity.
I think it's pretty clear to make the connections. I mean, if you look at what was happening, what was going on, Columbus was coming in, working for the King and Queen of Spain. The idea was to get, you have to remember, Spain, or what was just becoming Spain and what was just becoming a Europe at that time, because it was not Europe per se, and these were not really countries yet per se. Like, Columbus came from a city-state called Genoa. It wasn't even Italy at the time, but yet, of course, you know, the Italians have appropriated him and his legacy. But if you look at what happened, that whole region was involved in a battle between religions, between religious philosophies. There was the Christian religious philosophy and what they termed the Moorish philosophy, which we know as Islam. And that's what the Crusades are all about. And that's that whole thing. There was 800 years of war. And about the time that Columbus was leaving, they had retaken many areas, especially in Spain, and they were deporting people right at that early time, the last of these Islamics who didn't convert, Jewish populations, many of whom were merchants. They were just kicking everybody out who wasn't Christian and appropriating their goods, because the Christian kings and queens at that time were near the end of their... they were almost broke, to put it another way. They were almost broke, so they needed to replenish their wealth, and the only way to do that is by appropriating it from other peoples. And they had 800 years of war training, and so they used that ideology of spreading the Christianity, and also like I said earlier, by any means necessary, and that included militarization of countries, of communities, of peoples, and that's a big thing there, because native peoples in the Western Hemisphere were peoples. They had their own, and still do, languages, societies, communities, and ways of governing themselves, and ways of interacting with other communities, and you know, all of these things are often not really thought of, because back then we were considered something close to animals, because if we were not a Christian, then we must be an animal, and we must be an infidel, a heathen, a savage, etc. All this type of terminology. And I think when you look at it like that, and you look at, you know, this idea about the other, you know, the other people, these people that Christians could never really account for in their own history or oral tradition or their own doctrines, because we're not really talked about in the Bible. I know some people have tried to make linkages to tribes of Israel, and that native peoples are part of these 12 tribes of Israel, et cetera, but in our own oral traditions, it doesn't really mention that, you know? So I think it was a dilemma for the Christians at that time, finding all of these peoples who they were not really aware of, or that their religion didn't really speak about, you know? So what were these people? Were they human, or were they not human? And, you know, obviously they're the other. They're the ones to be feared, or they're the ones that, since they didn't understand them, you know, what happens when you don't understand something, you know, you either fear it, and then it could lead to violence at a certain point, because, you know, you want to retaliate, or it's just basic human nature in a lot of ways, I guess, you know, or at least from that perspective that was happening, that was their basic nature, to really lash out at peoples and to really consider them not human beings. And for those who don't think that that's a true statement, there was actually a very famous court battle that occurred during that time period between a man named Bartolomé de las Casas, who was the first bishop ordained in the hemisphere, in the quote-unquote New World, and another gentleman named Sepúlveda. And the whole argument in court was whether these New World peoples, these quote-unquote Indians, Indios, were actually human or not. And I think Sepúlveda presented his argument, and that was about maybe an hour or two worth of testimony. And then when Las Casas presented his presentation, it took quite a number of days to quote-unquote prove that we were indeed human, and et cetera. So why is that all important for today? Well, because many of these early interactions, actually, the results of those early interactions are still relevant today. For example, I mean, you can't go anywhere in Latin America without seeing Christian churches. And, you know, while I'm not against Christianity per se, it's just some of its ambassadors that I'm not happy with. And I don't, you know, Columbus was one of them. And you could see that in certain communities, how people are divided. I mean, I remember going one time to Guyana, and I was visiting one of the villages in the interior. And in that small village with only a few hundred residents, there were seven different Christian denominations. And nobody can ever get anything done, because they were always arguing amongst each other. Or they couldn't really, you know, you were told they're from this denomination, so we should really be on the side of our own, et cetera. And, you know, you really see a breakdown of community and as those indigenous family values when those kind of things happen. Imagine also that many of the churches, and this happened in the Caribbean everywhere, many of the churches were built right on native sacred sites, in other words, ceremonial grounds. and in ways to stamp out the local religions, they would tear down those places and build their churches in their town squares right smack on top of our sacred sites. So many churches around are built on indigenous sacred sites. It's important to understand those linkages because even today, there's been a campaign calling for progressive thinkers within the church system all the way up to the Pope. I mean, I don't know if we would call the Pope a progressive thinker or not, but there's been calls for quite a number of years, at least since 1992, to rescind what are known as the papal bulls. And these bulls were church edicts that were issued at the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 16th century that basically said that the lands that these folks found were theirs. In other words, the church was giving them the power to keep these lands, and they actually split it, the New World. They actually split the New World between the Spaniards and the Portuguese, and that's why today Brazil has the Portuguese language, and most of the other areas around Latin America have the Spanish language because of that early church edict, which gave them those lands and divided that new world. And basically, because the church felt that, one, they would get a share of these new resources coming in from the exploitation of the resources of the new world, and B, that the other side of it was the conversion of native peoples to Christianity. And it was a very aggressive conversion. You know, and that's one of the issues I have, that it's not a matter of just, you know, presenting ideologies and exchanging ideas and having people just, you know, come over to that side of their own free will. These were very aggressive conversions and as aggressive as they were taking lands for exploitation, you know. And why that's important, you know, say, well, that was in the 15th century, the 16th century. Why the heck is that important today? Why should the Pope rescind those original things? We've contacted the Vatican, a number of people who are working on these issues, and there's a lot of writers, in case, you know, people are interested. There's an author named Steve Newcomb that people might want to Google and check up on the work specifically about that issue. He's done a lot of great work, and even our own Taino people went with Steve and others, and they went to the Vatican to try to get the Pope to meet with them so that they could rescind these papal bulls, because the native peoples around the world feel that there's a real moral and spiritual element reason why they should be rescinding those, because it would help in the healing of a lot of people. It would begin or at least be part of that healing process and show that people really want to move on from those very dark times in those early centuries that we're talking about in the beginning of this colonial era. And of course the Vatican feels that they've done enough over the years to say that those papal bulls are not really valid, so why do we need to make a statement? But the people want a statement. You know, they want a statement that says officially that, you know, oppressing people, forcibly trying to convert them to foreign religions, these things are not right, and people would have outcries about them today. And then that's the other side of the story, right? Then people say, well, how can you compare the mindset of today with what was going back in Columbus's time? But it was very easy. There was protest back then against that very thing that they were doing. Even people within the church, and that's well documented. It wasn't a very popular thing to do, but it was well documented that there was church clergy, Bartolome de las Casas and others, who spoke out against that sort of abuse and that sort of aggressive conversion tactics. And being linked up to the Spaniards' militarization of the hemisphere. And again, why is this important? If you look at even the Supreme Court rulings for Native Americans or American Indians in the United States, a lot of these Supreme Court rulings are based on the so-called Doctrine of Discovery. And the Doctrine of Discovery goes back to the time of Columbus, and that these Europeans discovered these lands, and it was there, and it was linked to those very papal bulls. And that stuff is still on, and is linked to why there's a reservation system, why Native peoples in the United States are treated in the way that they are, and it's based on a lot of real law, even today, and it has that as its foundation, you know. And so there's many reasons why these things are valid, but again, when you look at what's going on, when you look at the state of the hemisphere, when you look at the state of indigenous spiritual practices, the assault on our sacred sites, you know, our places of worship or our special places, our sacred places, are not given the same consideration as Euro-American churches. And, you know, you can't go into a Euro-American church and start doing a ceremony whenever you want, or camp out there just because you feel like it, you know. And this is what happens in our, whether they're the sacred mountains like Mount Graham, or the San Francisco Peaks, or you know, places even in Boriking, where our sacred places are used as tourist attractions, you know, like they do with the Mayas in the Yucatan. You know, they have all these outlandish tales of Mayan sacrifice and all kinds of things going on in Chichen Itza. That's what thousands of people hear every day when they go to visit that place. But no one ever tells them that, you know, when those Europeans got there, Chichen Itza wasn't even inhabited, you know. They had already moved from that place. So how do they know what was going on and who was being thrown off of steps and tearing out hearts, etc.? I mean, a lot of, you know, it's propaganda, right? Again, to make us look as if we're savage, as if we somehow deserved to have these tragedies inflicted on us. Just the way, you know, some of these peoples are trying to deny what happened in the Holocaust with the people of Jewish faith, you know. And you have to see it. You have to link these things together, and you have to see that it's all part and parcel, and you cannot speak out against one and not link the other, you know. Just because you think that Columbus was somehow the beginning of civilization and all things good over here, maybe to some people, yeah, but not to all people, you know, and especially not to Native peoples. And, you know, there's still a lot of healing to be done. There's still, you know, we're still fighting for our rights every day. And if people don't think it's a reality, why do Native Americans in the United States have a Religious Freedom Act? Why are they the only segment of the population in the United States that needs a Religious Freedom Act? Aren't we all guaranteed freedom of religion in the United States? It goes to show you that these things, the prejudices, the stereotypes, and the outright racism against our peoples, Mucaro, still continues. Mucaro, it, you know. Mucaro, Mucaro.